Yeah, so, but you were around though. We're not quite ready to start, but I think Marvette needs to come back before we're ready to get the is ready for us.
Yeah, you know, when I think back about those times, what I have to say is we partied every night and we had a gloriously good time.
Okay. You ready to go, Marvette? Yeah, we're ready. Okay, good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night at 7 o'clock on the West Coast here, and we're studying Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. This is, in many ways, a crowning literary offering to us in terms of what we've been studying over the last several years. We've been studying practical work on self. We studied the joy of sacrifice, and we studied the human biological machine. And in a sense, you really need to study those to get to the point where we are now and to understand what you can now do now that you've entered the life of the labyrinth. Okay? So we're on chapter 3, M.A., and the first couple of chapters, what we did is we caught up and we talked about the fact that there is a labyrinth. And we talked a little bit about in chapter 2 about some of the reasons why it's not easy for us to get to and view it. And now, within chapter 3, we enter a different perspective of it altogether. Chapter 3 is a very important chapter in terms of I call it a pivotal chapter in terms of the way in which we will be working now. So in order to get started, do you want to get us started with the header there then?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, why don't you read that for us?
Okay, chapter 3, and I'm using a book that I originally Life in the Labyrinth in this edition. There are several editions.
And
but,
this is the, I'm using the new edition,
okay.
And I'll be calling the pages out from this one, and
okay.
They're very similar.
And if you happen to be in this one, there's no page number on the page I'm on, but it would be somewhere around 17.
And it is 17 in the other edition.
I guess you just love this drawing. I don't
know
if you have that drawing. No. But here's the drawing.
I don't know if you can see.
I don't know if people can see that, but it is quite nice. It's a E.J. Gold, A Strange Evening, Oil on Canvas Board, 20x24, 1987. Okay, Chapter 3, The Ultimate Puzzle. The labyrinth, as would any maze, has puzzle-like characteristics. Obeying the rules of puzzle-solving should, if the laws of signs are read correctly, enable us to voyage consciously as well as remember previous passages and have a connected overview which takes into account everything we have ever learned in the maze.
Okay. So the title of this chapter is The Ultimate Puzzle. And we're invited, in a sense, to let's talk about it. Let's enter into the maze now.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I want to caution, it's so easy to think of these things as out there. It's, oh, they're doing that. Oh, look at that. They had that. What I want to do is I want to see if we can find ways and means to bring it home so we can see that these are things that we're doing ourselves. Now, they will not be in the form of high-level, super-advanced voyaging. But, so it's like we can find little hints, and we can do it all the time and all day long. Just like when we talked about waking up the machine, and when can we do that? The same with noticing the clues. I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs quickly, and then talk about the next four or five paragraphs in general. but it'll get us going then, okay?
Have you mentioned Diablo in relationship to this at all? Yes.
It'll come.
Coming up. Okay.
No, we're not even to that level yet.
Okay.
Okay. So, but you'll have, the labyrinth, like any other maze, has puzzle-like characteristics. Although it is never intentionally designed as a puzzle, obeying the rules of puzzle solving will, if we understand the rules correctly and have read the signs aright, enable us to voyage consciously through the macro dimension, traversing the labyrinth as easily as we would solve a puzzle. Here's an example. Let's say the kind of puzzle we're trying to solve is a crossword puzzle. That's a type of puzzle, right?
Sure. I do them all the time. I love
you do? She loves crossword puzzles. Let's say that the hint is part of a foot.
Okay.
And you know, you have a toe, could be the muscles of a foot, right?
Yeah. I'd be looking at the puzzle to see how many letters.
She'd be looking for hints to tell her where to go.
Mm-hmm.
But see, think, you know, let's say you're starting to go up there. Maybe it's the arch of the foot or the heel. Mm-hmm. Heel, four letters.
Four-letter words.
Yeah, or maybe it's the, and it's, you know, all you anatomists out there will know the hundreds of pieces of a foot. But what if the answer is, and it says part of a foot, and the answer is an inch? Right?
Oh, that would be well short.
Suddenly you have to think in a new dimension to get it.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
So that's an example of puzzle hint. So you get the hint and you have to truly, and this is a hard one to get, but truly the key to it is a form of surrender. It's a form of surrender to surrender to what's going on about you in order to see what's going on about you. Computer games would be a very useful instruction for labyrinth navigation to gather puzzle-solving clues and to apply such clues in relation to the real labyrinth. And then in several paragraphs, EJ is talking about gaming and special games and the computer games, and you mentioned Diablo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole culture here at IBHHB of people playing computer games, and one of the ones that I think, and Molly is on with us tonight too, plays quite a bit, is Diablo. And that's a team game where you go to three different levels, so to speak, and you go and you solve different puzzles, each level bringing different combinations of those, and you begin to sense different things. Now, Claude Needham runs a lot of the Diablo voyages together with these groups of people, and this individual, Claude, is remarkably creative. And I think Molly can attest to the fact that there's almost an endless sort of combination in how you can approach the same problem. Because the game itself never changes, right? It's a computer game and it's a set of written code.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some variations in that code, but basically if you move to this point on the map, this creature comes out.
Or that you're in that particular level, whatever level that you navigate to. That's where you are. It doesn't all of a sudden another level hinge on the level that you're on. Changing the whole game. It's law conformable.
It's law conformable. What are those laws? Well, if you run that game, I'd say that thousands of times Claude has run that particular game, thousands. Once you do it like that, like any exercise, even if that exercise on the outside to the outside world appears to be passive. If you run that exercise over and over again, maybe even daily, you get to know your way into it. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does this make sense, Silverdale?
It certainly does. You're doing. I'm listening with great interest.
Passage. This one part, and have a connected overview which takes into account everything we have learned in the maze, and that's very apparent in the Diablo game. There are many games that give you that as well, but Diablo is a great example where it gives you an overview of the map, where you are, where you're going, where you've been, and tells you the information that you need to know, what level you're on, how much life force you have,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. So it gives you everything in the game that you've reached so far.
So that
tells you on that overview.
So what we're talking about there is the idea of puzzle solving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't want to get too much into the computer game thing because
mm-hmm.
a lot of people aren't playing computer games.
No, no.
So if they're not, it's just a manner in which to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it, if you wanted to use the game format, you can do it with board games, you could do it with any form of exercise that you work with over and over again in this field. And we're going to come to a very important phrase in just a moment, okay?
Okay.
All right. Because the game conforms to the same set of mathematical laws which govern the multidimensional labyrinth, both lateral and vertical movement through the domain will obey a subset of probabilities. Connectives may or may not be apparent to the voyager. Fortunately for the peace of mind of the shaman everywhere. Now, this is the phrase I'd like you to focus on. The factors which allow movement can be discovered by the attentive voyager only during the course of intentional involvement in the game. What does that mean? Only during intentional movement in the game.
Well, I have a little idea about that, but I'd like to see if anybody else has any.
Anybody, Molly? Okay.
You know, Dave, I'd like to just toss in, I thought you said something very significant last week, which is that in human biological machine, we're learning that we have an essential self, a more subtle electrical field within the grosser dimensionality of the human biological machine. And that this book presumes that we've achieved the separation or an awareness of how to separate our essential self from the biological machine, and now it's our essential self is learning a new landscape or a new environment within which to work, within which it can work. And within that context, this becomes an important sentence. The factors which allow movement can be discovered by the attentive voyager, that is the essential self, as it begins to, I mean, it's almost like weightlessness in space. You just learn how to move around because the equilibriums are different in that space. And, of course, this presumes, I suppose, a very high development or at least a modest development of the essential self as an independent life force animating not only our physical body but also able to participate in the world around us or the labyrinth around us.
Now, I didn't take it that heavy duty. I took it as an awake being.
Yeah.
So we went through the
That's right.
Human biological machine and the other books that you mentioned, and that was to wake us up. So to me, I didn't take it so that we made any inroads into that. Only that we are awake. That we've gotten that little part of it down.
But that's in human existence. That's a lot. Okay, that's a lot. That's a And very few people are in that position. Now, I really appreciate the Silverdale, what you had to say, because if we remember in the HBM, what it talks about is that the essential self, in a sense, is melded, it's welded to the power of the human biological machine. That's all it sees. So what, in a certain way, what eyes does it have? It just has the eyes of the machine. It has no other eyes. And then if it starts to awaken and it begins to decouple, in a sense, from, in a certain way, the servitude to the human biological machine, suddenly it can look around. But how, therefore, does it see? And that's what this book is about. Okay?
Developing other eyes.
Lupe, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Oh, what do you think it means by intentional involvement with the game?
For me, the intentional involvement means being able to recognize the spaces that you're traveling through in the small picture as well as in the big picture in itself. The big picture in itself is navigating through our world, the everyday world. For me right now, this particular instance, it's driving. I'm driving right now. And I've been noticing some of the spaces that have been changing for me specifically from a vibration frequency within the car, because I still have to pay attention to the big picture, which is driving on the road, making sure that I don't cause an accident. Yes, and noticing certain subtleties as far as changes that are taking place within my body. I'm feeling some tightening and different sensations. So for me, intentional navigation is trying to become aware of that and be able to see it and recognize it. And it's not easy, because it's a lot easier to just kind of like go through the routine and the motion of going on autopilot and just driving.
Great real world example. That
it's great.
Is wonderful.
Very well said. And very.
Yeah.
Because you're on the phone, you get put on the spot a little bit more.
I was not aware of that. Okay, thank you for the heads up now.
I expect
pay attention.
The ability to think in new categories and extend the boundaries of one's presence are the two most important tools we have available. My goodness.
Wait, out in black and white. I really appreciated that.
What is it? Wait a minute. What did he say here? The ability to think in new categories and extend the boundaries of one's presence are the two most important tools we have available. I love it. There it is. It's like, can we do that? Can we think in new categories? The second is the ability to extend one's presence.
Extend the boundaries of one's presence.
Extend the boundaries of one's presence. And we're going to get into that in a moment, what that means. This is new territory, and I know we're all timid, and we're all timid in our thoughts about this, but I encourage you to speak up. I mean, just rely on your intuition at this point. What does it hit when you think of these things? What comes up? What's up? What do you feel like? You know, all of those things. All right? Those are part of what your guides are going to be. We'll get into some very, very important things in Chapter 4, but we're being introduced now. Okay? We know how we're supposed to intentional involvement,
mm-hmm.
and the two characteristics again, I can't remember.
The two tools most important tools that we have available, to think in new categories and extend the boundaries of one's presence.
So the example of that I gave of the foot
mm-hmm.
and the foot, that's a good example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. In doing those crossword puzzles, you know, that thinking in new categories, it's exactly what you said. You
yeah.
know, it's two four-letter words that could be part of a foot, or another four-letter word that could be part of a foot.
By playing certain kinds of games where clues are assembled in various ways, the quantum leap can be made from the purely mental game, which might be presented via computer, to a very real game in which a maze is being traversed. The same principles apply. So what he's talking about here is we can talk about, oh, let's go and play that game. Or we can understand that we are in a maze right now. For instance, in driving, Lupa is in a maze. There's many ways to look at what she is doing. One is she's just driving a car. But the second she adds the formula called intentional involvement and begins to experiment with thinking in new categories and allowing her presence to expand, suddenly it's different. Something's different there. And we can almost be in that car with her, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can sense it.
Yeah.
And so there's a comment that we're gonna, I'm gonna try to get from the log. Go ahead. So Simon asks us a question. So Simon is saying, I'm wondering in this instance, what do new categories refer to? Did I get it? So new categories. You know, so the whole idea of thinking outside the box, Simon, and all of us, it's it ain't what it appears to be. It really isn't. And the way I put it, and you know, I put a lot of time into all this stuff, and so for me, they blend together like the practical work on self, and for me, the exercise, the door exercise. So when I walk through a door, it's almost second nature to me to perceive the fact that I'm walking into a different space, which, by the way, we will define in a minute. So it's almost as if there's a sense of anticipation at that moment. And the idea is to suspend judgment, Simon. And maybe that's the best way to talk about thinking in new categories, is to suspend the immediate judgment of the reactive linear mind. Because
mm-hmm.
that's what we want to do, right? Oh, I know what that is.
Well, I would think in that way it would be passively allowing the new categories to come in, rather than having the reactive mind make up new categories that are just part of the current paradigm.
I'd like to just look at one phrase that you used there. You said, you know, passively allow. In a certain way, it's passive, but passive from the point of view of surrender. And in order to be in that state, it takes an active will of intentionality to be there. It's not the will of a better thinker. When you are in that space, you naturally then wind up thinking outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
You naturally do, I guarantee it. And I mean, I had an instance this morning. Don't forget, I work I'm consulting with people in business. The presumed thought pattern is that a business is very straightforward and dry. Well, if that's how you think, guess what? It will be straightforward and dry. But if you don't, like I was just in this space with a business person and talking about their particular thing, and boom, a totally new category came up. And even they were amazed.
Hey, Dave, I'd like to throw in a comment here. I mentioned to you, I'm now reading the book, The Reality of Being, now for the sixth time. It's a significant book. And one of the distinctions it makes is between the known and the unknown, in which it describes how because we're so enslaved to words, ideas, beliefs, we're saturated with societal mentality that causes us to become involuntary slaves. Within the known, we hesitate to venture out of it into the unknown. But only by activating our essential self can we launch ourselves into the unknown, and now we enter a self-educating process. If
yes.
I'm in the unknown, what do I learn about it? And now perhaps we come up with new categories that don't fit into the known because, after all, we're in a different dimension.
I'll give you an example of that. there was an event. I can't give you the details, but it was a very, very intense chamber in which, you know, this was years ago when we were there with EJ. Very intense chamber, and he reached out his arm and inviting me to clasp his hand, which I did. I reached out, I extended my arm, clasped his hand, and there was a flow of energy that occurred, and he said, "That's a form of communication. Get it?" And the answer was, yes, I did. But I didn't have a linear I don't have a linear explanation, but I'm convinced I got dot data. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Molly. Mark says that in order to help get into new categories, humor is a good tool. And that's the punchline, you know, like the punchline in a joke throws you into a wonder state. You expect one answer, and suddenly there's a different answer, and we laugh, but it also, it's a wonder point. A very good example, Mark. Very, very good. Okay? Simon says hello, and a special hello to Silverdale.
It's reciprocal.
Reciprocal. So jumping ahead just a little bit, in the labyrinth, reality is fleeting and intensely subjective. That is why we must first know who we are. Only then can we begin to understand where we are, why we are here, and our possible destination. What does that mean? Anybody? Come on. Anybody? I need an answer. Bad.
I think the who is what we covered in the previous book.
Ah, I see.
That to me is where we were in those books, is the who of us.
I have a little bit of a different answer,
okay.
But go ahead.
Well, that's what I was going to say, the who of us.
Okay.
Was contained in the work that we did in the previous book.
All righty. So where we are, why we are here, and possible destination. these things mean? Molly, give me an answer. She has an answer. She doesn't. Speaking up for the comment. Go ahead. So for Arya, expansion of presence has to do with putting her attention outside herself. On the space and in the environment. Good comment. And seeing herself as part of that space connected to everything. Perfect comment for the next section, too, that we're going to get into. Very good. So somebody, can somebody tell me who I am, by the way? Where we are. Where are we, by the way? No one's venturing that one.
Well, hey, Dave, I just want to remind you that, you know, over the lintel at that Delphic temple were the words Gnosis say, Aton, know thyself. And in one of those Socratic scenarios, Socrates and his disciple are walking along, and Socrates turns to his disciple. Did you notice what it says over that lintel? And the guy said, oh, yeah, Gnosis Aton, know thyself. And Socrates says, well, what does that mean but to know the power within and how to use it? By which I take that to be a reference, not what is your name and when's your birthday, but do you know the power within? Do you know your essential self and how it might be used by great nature? And I really think that's what this paragraph refers to, knowing yourself. That is knowing not your historical personality, but knowing the power within, in potentia, the essential self, and how it might be used to alleviate the suffering of the absolute.
Well, I don't know if you're right about that, Silverdale.
Okay.
When I was 19, I got my first copy of The Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky.
Oh.
And on the cover, it says, know thyself. I was just so excited to get this document. I brought it home. I talked to my father about it. And he says, what do you mean? I'm the guy sitting here talking to you. That's who I am. I think he proved your point. Yes,
yeah.
Molly. Who? Okay. The who is the being nature? The voyager and the being nature. And this... And where we are is identified with some chamber in 11. This is exactly right. So the who we are starts to now not become, hey, I'm the guy talking to you. It becomes, who am I as a voyager? And to start to embrace that side of ourselves is actually kind of scary. It's frightening to say, I am a voyager. Because I'll bring this up because it was in many chambers this question came up. And where does the voyager lie its head? Does the voyager go home at night? And by definition, the answer is no. Go ahead, Molly. And so Arya says we have to recognize we are the voyager in the labyrinth. And the previous comment that it's a space in the labyrinth. Yeah. And can you ask if that is in fact who it is? Yeah, to know we are in the dream, traveling through the maze. Okay. So Mark tells us to look for an experiential answer, and that's where we are going here, is we're going to find out where we are, and as Silverdale tells us, we're discovering it from a different point of view, not from the point of view of the historical personality, the history of this physical envelope that we maintain, but as a voyager. What is our signature? And once you start looking at this, you're going to see, excuse me, you're going to start seeing in a different way. You'll see people, you'll literally see them with a different set of eyes. I noticed a long time ago that I don't give my eyesight, this eyesight with my ocular vision, as much due as I should. I actually wind up seeing somewhere in from the heart chakra. I literally look that way with my eye, and that's so when I walk up to somebody, that's what I see. So we begin to get a sense of who we might be. Everybody has this. Everybody's exactly has different characteristics, exactly like that. Very good comments. Thank you. We'll save possible destinations for later, though. Okay, we're going to jump ahead another paragraph. Chambers refer to the morphology of any stabilized field anomaly. So now we have, I wrote down, that's our first functional definition then. Because we always hear the term, oh, it's this chamber or that chamber. This is on page 19. So mark that as a definition. So there's a fluidity throughout. There's a movement of energetic life as we go through everything, as we go through this labyrinth. And at some point, it stabilizes. There's like a calling to sit there and be there in that space for a little while. That's a chamber. Okay, so what these are hints, as we'll see at the very last paragraph of this chapter, it's a hint that we have to actually discover ourselves. Okay? Any comments on that or anything you want to say, Anae?
A stabilized field anomaly is very technical. Physics term. I think that's out of the realm of make-believe. I think that's right. That this is a actual statement here. It's not, it wasn't made up just to make it pretty. You know, stabilized field and anomaly.
Not,
I
not
think
at
that
all.
It's you know it's giving us
an exact
physics definition.
One of the things I can say that I have witnessed directly, let's just say, in those chambers, exactness in the ability to recognize, move, and utilize those spaces. So we're moving toward learning how to become better in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an exact definition. Yeah, it is that a chamber is, it refers to the morphology of any stabilized field anomaly. Okay. And the next paragraph, he defines space. And then there's the word space and then jump to the last sentence in that paragraph. It refers to the subjective experience one can have of chambers and dimensions, meaning the qualitative aspect. Okay, so chamber and the space is how we perceive it. It's our interaction with it. So the space, in a sense, is a potentiality. And the chamber is a potentiality And the space is, in a sense, what we make of it when we're there. Now, Lupa, the next thing that I'm going to read, and Aria, this is on page 20. You can write it down. This is the that second full paragraph on this page. Spaces will have smells, texture, depth, width, thickness, consistency, color, atmosphere. They will carry moods, emotions, feelings, and sensations of a very definitive type. They will also contain data, understanding, cognitions, perceptions, and knowledge. They will be familiar or foreign, attractive or repulsive, comfortable or eerie. So the experiment that you can work with, if you do work with a group, at least a couple, would be better, 3, 4, 5 people. And when Claude and I used to do this thing called Barter Boot Camp, we would do this. You go around and you say to everybody in the group, you say, tell me some characteristic of this space that we're in now. Someone will say, oh, yellow. And the other person might say, it's cool. The other person might say, it's kind of a funny space. The other one might say, there's a red tone to it. And if you do that a couple of rounds, 2 or 3 rounds in the group, then note where you have come. You have to realize that you will be in the exact same physical space, physical locale, but you will have gone into a different chamber. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you go around like we can just try it here. There's just a small group of us here, and just you won't be able to hear it, but I'll start slightly hazy.
Enclosed.
Coolness.
What was that?
Coolness. The space feels cool.
Cool.
Or cold. Not cold, but not hot either.
Cool.
Cool, yes.
Huh? Eerie.
No, airy.
Airy. Wind, like an airy, like wind. Do you have something?
Slightly heavy.
Susan, slightly
yes.
Heavy. Nice. Electric. Now it's my turn again. Yellow.
Noisy.
Quiet. Molly. Purpley. Now, and if you do that, you actually start to define the chamber that you're in, and you go start to go into it. It's electrically very potent to do that. Now, you take it to the next level. Let's say you have 3, 4, let's say you have 5 or 6 people there. You let people begin to speak that just as they do. Then it doesn't have to go just exactly circular around the space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and that's what I call angel speak. It comes up when it's needed to come up. It just pops out in the right way. Angel speak, so to speak.
And then were you saying that once you do that, then you wind up in a different chamber? Is
yeah.
that what you're getting
yeah.
to?
It's a method of voyaging.
Mm-hmm.
And David, you know what's astonishing to me about this particular paragraph, spaces will have smells, textures, is that as I read it, am I correct in understanding these are attributes of the essential self? This is not necessarily our historical personality identifying these characteristics. These are attributes of an essential self that is operative, forming these perceiving these various aspects of the chamber or the space.
Yeah, now I call this technique a bridge. It's a bridge from really living in the human biological machine and the linear world to the essential self being the guide, being the voyager and the guide. It's taking the same principles, yellow, airy, hazy, cool, quiet, noisy, but they suddenly, it's like the opposite of what happens with the machine, Silverdale, that the machine co-opts the experiences of the essential self and brings it down into the world of the human biological machine. It steals it. This is flipping it. It's like a technique to take what is in the HBM and making it, co-opting it for voyaging purposes. So the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, remarkable.
It is interesting. But what is the key element in this kind of gameplay? Intentionality. And so if you're focusing on intentionality, then you can't be stuck in the human biological machine. You are, by definition, somewhere else.
Voyaging.
You're primed for voyaging. Mm-hmm. Yes, Molly. Simon has more questions about the stabilized field anomaly.
Well, I would ask him if the space that he's in now is a stabilized field anomaly.
Yeah, and I think, Simon, that when I hear that question, my answer goes to it's experiential. It's really experiential. It's like you're voyaging along and you find the chamber. Like the chamber is there. I do readings every once in a while for people that are, have passed, and I do labyrinth ABD readings. When I come close to my altar area, it's pretty potent. It just stops. I can't be in the HBM in that space. So I recognize that is a stabilized field anomaly right there. By that, maybe a way to do it linearly is to say that the flow of magnetic energy and energies stabilize in a certain format. I think he uses the word a tableau.
A frozen tableau.
It's a frozen tableau. Mm-hmm. So it's like you might be moving down a river, and it's like the pond, you're going down a river and you rush, and then the river opens up and there's like a whole pool there, right? That's a stabilized field anomaly. And that's where you go swimming. It's true. Okay, go ahead, Molly. Yeah, so Lost Horizon says that, like, when you have a plate with sand particles, other particles on it, and it vibrates at a certain thing, and the patterns are formed in the sand, you change the frequency, it changes that pattern. And yeah, so Mark agrees that it's like a cosmic equivalent of an eddy in a river.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of rivers around here. I go hike along those rivers. Bless you. So we're going to have to keep going here. Oh, boy. I don't know if we can get through this in one day. It's already almost 8 o'clock. You know what? I'm just going to, I'm not going to push this one, all right?
Okay.
Because it's a key, it's a pivotable. Pivotal chapter. And it's important that we get some of these and spend our time on it. It's okay with me if we go to some of it until next week or even takes 2 weeks to get through it. Because the next paragraph is just as important. We can enter a space, leave a space, sense a space, break a space, space out. All of those, hopefully you have experience and understand precisely what that means. The difference is you'll never hear a professional voyager chambering out. Molly says she has a good idea of what it means. Well, what does it mean?
Have you chamber out?
Not the whole chamber, just leave. It's up and leave. It's like it's the spring.
But the Voyager, so we understand, like everybody has been in various spaces and different schools that they work with and different lectures, your talks and things you've been to, interactions that you've had. And you know that you've been in that space and you can tell when somebody's space is out. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, she says.
I can tell when I space out.
She can tell even when she spaces out. So for the moment, let's just focus on that. And see what that might mean for us. So like when you are, if you have the opportunity to work in a group with somebody, you can experiment with some of these things. The labyrinth is a great multi-dimensional cardboard cutout whose inner matrices form along invisible ley lines. Ley lines being like the magnetic lines, juxtaposed with alternating topological connections and discontinuities. So that's just let's say, an energetic or magnetic description of it. There are, in a sense, ways to easily move and ways to not easily move. I'm just gonna take my time.
I just picked that as the earth.
The earth?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I just took the whole the thing to be huge. The labyrinth.
Well,
you know, I mean, you can take it out to a very large space.
I certainly don't understand precisely why we are on this earth, but the things that we're talking about are not limited to this earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's, we clearly have a handle on how to voyage elsewise. And that's, we're preparing ourselves for that. And the next, the end of this next paragraph, as in any electrical, elaborate geometric construct, access points and blockages are to be found everywhere. Access points and blockages. Some blockages actually exist objectively. Heat expansion, impedance, effects in the labyrinth itself. Others artificially created by ourselves. Now, the last sentence, where there is no wall, no actual impedance, we painstakingly erect an area of futility. We erect that to satisfy our own primate sense of security. This is where it gets very difficult, because there is no question that when we are voyaging, there's a fear element that sometimes is very powerful because you have left the human dimension and you're frightened. You're truly frightened. Don't panic. Ever heard that one?
Mm-hmm.
Don't panic. It's okay to get frightened. It really is. Courage is not proceeding without fear. Courage is proceeding in spite of the fear.
My habits will carry me through.
If you have those habits. And that's what we're talking about right now, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And the good reason to develop those habits for this very objective of voyaging.
But that's a nice phrase. We painstakingly erect an area of futility. Beautiful, very poetic. In the real world, the unobstructed universe in which our morphological presence has expanded into the whole field of all possible attention points, we are rarely prepared for the unconnected events and rarely, if ever, see things coming, even though they may see clear, we may see clear signals long in advance. I wanted to expand on that. And does that hit anybody, that last phrase there? We may see signals long in advance.
Or the way I used to describe this, we can all see the horizon, we just don't know the details of it.
Okay. So, Susan, I can hear you very loudly silent there. Are you still there? Maybe not.
I'm here.
So, what do you think that means?
Well, it's certainly easier to look back and see the signals after it's come to fruition.
Yes, good point.
And then we can see how things really are connected. But it's hard to not have our vision occluded so that we can see it coming.
Okay. We don't believe ourselves. I told the story, I think, at some point. I'm driving home from a client down in Sacramento, and I'm about 20 minutes from Grass Valley. I'm actually listening to a particular book, and then I got this overwhelming desire that I should call Gracie, one of our friends here in the community. Overwhelming desire to give her a call. That's pretty weird. So I turn the recording off, and I'm not that great, you know, on the phone. I have a hands-free phone thing. But I was just thinking, well, maybe I'll just wait till I get home. It's about 15 minutes. 2 minutes later, the phone rings, and it's Gracie.
Oh, wow.
Now, when I got that sensation, I didn't wonder at it. I didn't do what it said a few paragraphs ago that says, expand, think outside categories. I didn't. But I would say that there was an actual signal that came to me that said that she was about to call me. The true and actual signal. And I picked it up, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
But what didn't I do?
Act on it.
I didn't pay attention to it. I didn't wonder about it. I go, oh, I think I should probably call her. So the tone of whatever that message was came in, and then immediately I started interpreting it. Oh, I guess I'm supposed to call her. No, I was probably picking that up, that she was thumbing around for my phone number somewhere. So it's those kinds of things that actually do occur. They actually occur to us, and we have a chance to listen to them.
I called somebody this morning, and she said, oh, I was just thinking about you.
And it's that kind of thing. There's truth to that. But we don't think of those signals in the same way, do we? because they're not very viable. Go ahead.
It's like tuning into the channel.
There you go. Okay, so that's what I think is meant by the last phrase in that paragraph. Is that even though we may see clear signals long in advance, and in order to allow the signals to hit us, we have to suspend judgment. I'm very cognizant of the time, and our agreement is to go for about an hour. But there's some very important paragraphs coming up that I really want to take time on. So why don't we just continue this next week? Because there's like two or three things that I really want to spend time on to dig into. And I don't know if you can make it back for part two of chapter three. Is that even possible?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
we'll send Ivan on another errand, another poetic errand.
We'll get Ivan back on
in the future.
In another couple of weeks.
I was thinking about how to do that. I think I have a way of setting that up, by the way.
Maybe Ivan won't be off the hook. He'll sit in with us.
And Molly, is there anything else? Okay, and if someone could send me the log. And Ari, if you're going to send it, copy Lupe on it too. And so that's the end of part one of chapter three of Life in the Labyrinth. It's a short chapter. We didn't get through it. But I think it was enough of a meal for one evening. So I thank you, everybody, for coming, and thanks for participating on the phone, all of you.
Thanks, Dave and M.A., for hosting us.
And we'll look forward to seeing everybody next week at 7 o'clock.
Wednesday night.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Drive safe,
Lupe. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.